that this time a filibuster might not win, and that even if it did, it would inflame Northern passions and make more likely a future change in Rule 22. Skeptical of that assessment, several of the Southerners weren't sure that Russell himself really believed in it, but no one wanted to argue with him. It was in summing up the feeling around the Oval Table that Harry Byrd said simply, "Dick, it's up to you." One of the other senators would later describe the strategy agreed on at the meeting. "Instead of ranting and raving, we'd talk about the merits of the bill, at least for a while." The strategy was flawless. Thanks to the new allies Russell's speech had won for the South, there was now little danger that the bill would come to a vote if the Southerners didn't want it to. Since an old-style filibuster, an adamant, defiant, blatantly obvious attempt to cripple the Senate, might hurt the South in future years, if possible, that type of filibuster should be avoided, held off to the last possible minute and used then only if it was absolutely necessary. And after Russell's speech, a filibuster could be held off to the last possible minute. It was no longer necessary at the beginning of the fight over the Civil Rights Bill. The Southerners could wait until the end, until just before the votes either on the motion to bring the bill to a vote or on the bill itself, and see if the bill had been hammered into a shape acceptable to them. And if it hadn't, if they still hadn't gotten what they wanted, they could always filibuster then. They could keep that weapon in reserve, holding it for the last stand, because, thanks to the speech in Hell's Canyon, they could be sure that in that last stand, the filibuster would win. These facts had the most ominous implications both for the cause of civil rights and for Lyndon Johnson. For both the cause and himself, he needed to pass a bill, needed to persuade the South to compromise. His strongest argument to persuade the South to do that had been that it was isolated, utterly without allies, that a filibuster might be defeated. That argument had now been destroyed. The South no longer had to compromise. For months, the South, Russell, had been insisting on the addition of amendments that would eliminate Part 3 and add jury trials to the bill. Now those amendments had to be added, or there would be no bill. The South would have to be given what it wanted. But to add those amendments, Johnson would have to find liberal and Republican votes, votes it seemed impossible for him to find. As the Senate recessed for the 4th of July holiday, it seemed inevitable that the end of the 1957 civil rights fight would be simply another filibuster. Lyndon Johnson wasn't in Washington that 4th of July weekend. On June 23rd, shortly after Russell had told him he had decided to give his speech, Johnson had abruptly left Washington for the Pardinalis Valley. At least some of his key and worried Washington advisers believed that he knew the impact that Russell's speech would have and felt it would destroy his last hopes of getting a compromise, and that he had, in Tommy Corcoran's phrase, given up and wanted to be identified as little as possible with another civil rights defeat. He stayed on his ranch for 2 weeks, continuing his months-long public silence on the issue, but removing himself as far from the Washington spotlight as possible. On the ranch, the days were filled with lolling around and occasionally floating in the pool, with business meetings with KTBC salesmen and executives, drives around the ranch to inspect the cattle and into Austin for dinner at El Matamoros and El Toro with his young staff members Bill and Nadine Brammer and Mary Margaret Wiley, and long domino games. One with Wesley West, A.W. Morsund, and Gene Chambers began in the morning, resumed after lunch, and then, after dinner at the West Ranch, went on there for several more hours. What was noticeable was the absence, to any substantial degree, of telephone calls back to Washington on Senate business. Mary Rather's log of telephone calls showed that very few were being made to senators. Near the end of the 2 weeks, however, George Reedy telephoned Johnson to read him a memo that had been received that day in the Washington office. The memo told him that, hopeless though the fight for a civil rights bill might seem, he could not avoid it and should stop trying to do so. And the memo was from the man who Johnson felt knew, had proven he knew, how to become president. The memo's first line was a little sarcastic. "I hope you are finding the Pardinalis River peaceful before the coming storm," Jim Rowe wrote. And the rest of it told Johnson in notably candid terms that if he wanted to become president, he had no choice as to what he had to do in the civil rights fight. "As you probably know," the memo said, "both your friends and your enemies are saying that this is Lyndon Johnson's Waterloo. They are saying that you are trapped between your Southern background and your desire to be a national leader and that you cannot escape. I personally think this is Armageddon for Lyndon Johnson. To put it bluntly, if you vote against a civil rights bill, you can forget your presidential ambitions in 1960. To keep those ambitions alive, Rose Memorandum said, it was necessary for Johnson not merely to vote for a civil rights bill, but to fight for one. Lyndon Johnson would have to be active in bringing about cloture, if that was necessary. It was necessary not merely that he fight, but that he win. The important thing about civil rights in 1957 is to pass a civil rights bill solely for the purpose of getting this absurd issue off the hill for a few years. Andrew said it was necessary that the bill that was passed not be identified as a Republican bill, but as a Lyndon Johnson bill. The public relations are most important. It would be most important that Johnson get all the credit for getting a compromise bill through. Following this course is imperative, Rose said. It may not be imperative to Johnson, but it is imperative to Roe. I would not like to see the 1960 nomination go down the drain because of one vote in 1957. Roe's memo was read to Lyndon Johnson on July 3rd, and the next day there was only one guest for dinner at the Johnson Ranch, and the identity of that guest was interesting in light of the lasting hold on Johnson's emotions that was exerted by anything that had to do with his family. The guest was his 28-year-old cousin, William Corky Cox, and Corky's life had intersected with Johnson's 20 years earlier, when Johnson, then 28 himself, had been in another situation that appeared hopeless. Despite his weeks of desperate effort, newspaper polls published on March 25, 1937, 2 weeks before Election Day, showed him further behind than ever in his first campaign for Congress. The custom in the Hill Country's little towns was for a candidate to be introduced at rallies by the town's most prominent citizens. By now, these leaders had almost all endorsed one or another of his opponents, and that day Johnson had learned that not a single prominent person could be found to introduce him at any of the next day's rallies. Lyndon was very dejected as he sat in his parents' home in Johnson City that evening, talking to his parents, his brother, his Uncle Tom, his cousin Ava Johnson Cox, and Ava's 8-year-old son, Corky. But as it happened before in times of political crisis for Lyndon, his father had a suggestion for him. The leader's opposition could be made to work for him, Samuel E. Johnson said. Instead of trying to conceal their opposition, Lyndon should emphasize it by being introduced by the antithesis of a veteran leader, by a young child who would recite a particularly appropriate poem. You know the poem, Sam told Rebecca, the one about the thousands. The child Sam had in mind was Corky, who, in an area in which horsemanship was esteemed, was being called the best young cowboy in the Hill Country because of his riding and calf-roping feats in children's events in recent rodeos. Corky can do it, Sam said. And Corky did do it. The next day, a vicious Texas norther had hit the Hill Country, but all that day Lyndon and Corky had driven from town to town through freezing rain that rolled across the hills in blinding sheets. And in each town, Lyndon would tell the audience, "They say I'm a young candidate. Well, I've got a young campaign manager, too." And then Corky would recite a stanza of Edgar A. Guest's It Couldn't Be Done. "There are thousands to tell you it cannot be done. There are thousands to prophesy failure. There are thousands to point out to you one by one the dangers that wait to assail you. But just buckle in with a bit of a grin. Just take off your coat and go to it. Just start in to sing as you tackle the thing that cannot be done, and you'll do it." And when the boy finished, Lyndon would take off his coat and give his version of a bit of a grin and attack the thousands who said that just because he was behind, he couldn't win. That corny poem and the fresh-faced boy who delivered it had touched a chord with the audiences of farmers and their wives and had ignited Lyndon Johnson's campaign, and, hard as he had run before, now, with the race seemingly lost, he ran harder, ran to victory. This scene is adapted from Volume 1, The Path to Power, pages 428 to 430. For another suggestion of his father's during this campaign, see page 399. No one, of course, can know for certain the role memories may have played down on the Johnson Ranch during those 2 weeks in 1957. and it may have been only coincidence that on July 4, 1957, the day after he heard Jim Rowe's memo, Ava Cox received a telephone call from her cousin Lyndon asking where Corky was living these days. Ava said that her son was a schoolteacher down in Ingram, near Kerrville, a town about 60 miles south of Johnson City, and Johnson telephoned him and said he'd like to drive down and see him. That evening, he brought Corky back to the Johnson Ranch for dinner. No one knows what they talked about. Corky Cox died in 1993. But when, on July 6th, Lyndon Johnson returned to Washington, hard as he had fought before for the Civil Rights Bill, now, with the fight seemingly lost, he fought harder. True to his word, Noland introduced, shortly after the Senate reconvened on Monday, July 8th, his motion to proceed to the consideration of the Civil Rights Bill, to bring the bill to the floor for debate. Carrying out Russell's strategy, Southern senators began to discuss the motion, not by reading recipes or the phone book, but in germane, if lengthy, arguments. The South knew that if the bill came to a vote in its present form, with Part 3 in it, it would pass, despite the votes of some far Northwest and Mountain States senators, and of the five or six reactionary Midwestern Republicans, whose support for the measure had been stripped away by Russell's speech and Eisenhower's admission. A solid majority of the Senate was still for it. Lyndon Johnson knew, as the historian Robert Mann writes, the price for Southern acquiescence, to render the bill a toothless voting rights measure. Most immediately, the price was the removal of Part 3. But Johnson also knew that he did not have the votes to pay this price. To persuade the South to stop talking and allow the Civil Rights Bill to come to the floor, he would have to get more votes from Republicans, and he would have to get some from liberals, too. In an attempt to do so, he deployed, upon his return from Texas, his most powerful weapons against the largest targets. The intellect and eloquence of Richard Russell were now deployed in the privacy of the Oval Office. During his July 3rd press conference after Russell's speech, Eisenhower had said he would be glad to talk to Russell personally about his administration's bill, but Russell had done nothing about the invitation. Immediately upon his return to Washington on July 6th, Johnson, aware, as Roland Evans was to put it, of Russell's rare ability to articulate his point, urged him to accept, urged him so forcefully that on July 10th, Russell met with the president for almost an hour. That must have been quite a meeting. No one knows exactly what was said in it. Writing to a friend about it, Eisenhower described an exchange that cast him in a favorable light. After Russell had delivered an impassioned talk on the sanctity of the 1896 decision, Plessy, by the Supreme Court, Eisenhower wrote, "I merely asked, then why is the 1954 decision not equally sacrosanct?" Russell stuttered and finally said, "There were wise men on the court. Now we have politicians." Then, according to Eisenhower, he asked Russell to name a single member of the 1896 court, and "he just looked at me in consternation and the subject was dropped." The president's description may not, however, have reflected with total faithfulness the overall tenor of his remarks. Recalling the meeting years later, Russell said, "He, Eisenhower, just sat there and poured out his soul about that bill and the Supreme Court and several other things. I was amazed, and then I realized that he had known me for a long time." Emerging from the White House, Russell, in answering the questions of a small knot of reporters, gave his customary modest disclaimer of influence. "I couldn't say we had a meeting of the minds," he said. "The president and I don't agree on the basic philosophy of the legislation." Asked if he felt better than he had before he saw Eisenhower, Russell replied, "I can't say that I do." But adding that, "I think in the course of the discussion there were some features I emphasized that the president had not considered," he said that the president's mind is not closed to possible amendments to clarify the bill. And privately, reporting on the meeting to his Southern colleagues, he went a little further. The president indicated in effect to Senator Russell that he would not be averse to considering some changes. Willis Robertson was to write a friend the next day, and Ann Whitman spoke to the president immediately after Russell left. "While emotional about the matter, he, Russell, conducted himself very well," she wrote in her diary. And while the meeting may or may not have made Russell feel better, it definitely made Whitman, a fervent believer in civil rights, feel worse. Despite her almost invariably unquestioning loyalty to Eisenhower's policies, she wrote in her diary on this occasion that the president is not at all unsympathetic to the position people like Senator Russell take, and was far more ready than I am, for instance, to entertain their views. Whitman may even have offered a rare face-to-face rebuke to her boss for doing so. For, she wrote, he reminded her that I have lived in the South, remember. Russell's visit to the Oval Office was followed, probably that same day, by one from Lyndon Johnson. The majority leader came secretly. No reporters were waiting for him when he emerged from the White House, because no reporters knew he was there. His limousine didn't stop where reporters could see it. And so far as can be determined, neither Eisenhower nor Johnson ever wrote a word about the meeting. "He sneaked down to see us," Bryce Harlow would tell the author. "He called me and said he wanted to see Ike and that he couldn't afford to have anyone know he was asking. It was very important. I laid it on, very confidential. No one was to know he was there, just the three of us, in the Oval Office. His limousine drove past the main entrance and stopped by the Oval Office entrance, and I brought him in the side door to the Oval Office." That must have been quite a meeting, too, if of a tone quite different from the other. "This wasn't fun and games," says Harlow, who sat in on the meeting, although I never wrote a memo for the Record about it, and said he could not recall any details about it. "These were big boys." In discussing, years later, the fate of Part Three, Brownell would link it to that meeting, which Eisenhower had described to him. Eisenhower had indeed, Brownell said, become worried that Part Three would involve his administration in a myriad of school desegregation cases, but I had tried to assure the president otherwise. But, Brownell would say, Lyndon Johnson went directly to the Oval Office. A shrewd political operator, he had unprecedented power over the Senate. And in this meeting, he let the president know how he was prepared to use that power. Let him know, Brownell says, in very blunt terms, what would happen to the bill if Part Three was not removed. Johnson told Ike that the entire bill would be defeated on the Senate floor if Section 3 was included. He said he had the votes to do this. And he made Eisenhower understand that he would do this. The president was convinced. Beyond this, he let the president know not only what would happen to the Civil Rights Bill, but what would happen to other bills the president wanted passed. Eisenhower was dealing with a hostile Democratic majority in the Senate, and the fate of much of the administration's legislative program in the Senate hung in the balance. Majority Leader Johnson made that clear to the president. And, Brownell says, Eisenhower therefore made a highly practical decision. It was a political decision. Eisenhower concluded that this political compromise was a necessary price to pay to get other badly needed administration bills through Congress before the end of the session. At his next press conference, the president made his position on Part Three clear. First, he reiterated his belief that the most important part of the bill was not the one that would foster faster school desegregation, but the one furthering the right to vote. And when Roland Evans asked whether in that case he was convinced that it would be a wise extension of federal power at this stage to permit the Attorney General to bring suits on this motion to enforce school segregation in the South, Eisenhower replied, "Well, no," and later said, "I personally believe if you try to go too far too fast in laws in this delicate field that has involved the emotions of so many million Americans, you are making a mistake." Eisenhower's statement gave Johnson new Republican votes for the elimination of Part Three, but only a few. Having learned that Eisenhower could be flouted with impunity, Republican senators were more susceptible to the arguments, of either conscience or calculation, made to them by Noland and Nixon, particularly by the latter. They felt that Nixon was likely to become the next president, and that he would be a very different kind of president from Eisenhower, more likely to remember who had not gone along with him. The arguments and pressure of their Senate leader and the vice president held a majority of the Republican senators in line behind Part Three. If there was a single key target on the Democratic liberal side, a single liberal who could, more than any other, perform the most impossible task of persuading other liberals to change their views and accept a civil rights bill limited to voting rights, a bill without Part Three, in other words, it was Joe Rao, chairman of both the ADA and the Civil Rights Leadership Conference. Rao was also, however, perhaps the liberal leader whose feelings about Lyndon Johnson came closest to outright hatred. He hated him because of what Johnson had done 8 years before to Leland Olds, a great American, a hero of mine, and because of that 76-6 vote against Paul Douglas. It was just Johnson putting his foot on Douglas's face, and because of a score of other anti-liberal and, in Rao's view, unnecessarily cruel actions by Lyndon Johnson in the years between the Olds and Douglas episodes. Rao's very acceptance speech, when he had been elected ADA chairman in 1955, had been largely an attack on Johnson. Johnson had been able to go to Eisenhower. There was no point in his going to Rao. Rao's closest friends, however, included the man who was Johnson's most powerful liberal weapon, Philip Graham, and another potent liberal, Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, for whom Rao had in his youth been a clerk. And now Rao received a call from Phil Graham inviting him and his wife Ollie down to the Graham's farm, Glen Welby, for the day, and asking him to bring the justice along. Rao was to recall that at first he didn't suspect any ulterior motive in the invitation, not even when, all the way out on the hour-plus drive to Glen Welby, there was this business from Felix about the only thing that counts is the right to vote. I never even thought there was anything more to it than a nice friendly afternoon of playing tennis and swimming in the Graham's pool. Then came cocktails, Rao was to say, and Phil and Felix and I are starting to talk some more. By God, if Phil doesn't sound just like Felix on the right to vote. Both of them hammered at me. The only thing that matters is the right to vote. We had the goddamnedest argument. At dinner, the topic remained the same. Phil was saying that we shouldn't be so obstinate in demanding everything at once, that we'd get the right to vote first, and that was the most important. Both of them hammered at me, and even then I could hardly recognize that this was not just a dinner party, that I was being worked on. It took a long time, Rao says, for him to realize that Felix and Phil and Johnson had had a very thorough talk, and that the afternoon in the country was a cute way for Lyndon to exercise his will. The exercise failed, however. The day at Glen Welby left Rao unconvinced. Black Americans had waited so long for the rights embodied in Part 3. Now, at last, there was a solid majority in the Senate behind those rights. Were black Americans to be told they would have to wait still longer? Rao remained adamant in his determination to keep Part 3 intact. Which meant that Lyndon Johnson still couldn't pay the Southern price, and there seemed no way for him to get more of the Republican and liberal votes he needed to pay it. Offering his motion on Monday, July 8th, Noland emphasized that he was asking merely that the bill be brought off the calendar to the floor and debated there. The motion, he said, was simply to enable the Senate of the United States to perform its legislative function. From the other side of the aisle, the Democratic civil rights leader reiterated the point. Noland's motion is merely that the Senate proceed to consider the civil rights bill, Paul Douglas said. He is not at this time moving its passage. Both senators said that therefore they would refuse to consider any amendments until that motion was passed. Then and only then will it be germane for us to discuss the merits of the bill itself, Noland said. Until the bill is on the floor, I shall resist any amendment, Douglas said. Should the South attempt to filibuster Noland's motion, the two senators said, they would invoke cloture, and they said they had the votes to do so. Republican leaders agreed. A civil rights bill will pass at this session without compromise, Richard Nixon said flatly. We'll win on Part 3, Sherman Adams said. We have our finger on the Senate pulse. We know what's going on. Behind Noland's bluster was apparently belief. He told a GOP legislative leaders' meeting that he expected the vote on his motion to be successful. With the bill then on the floor, there might perhaps have to be some clarifying amendments, he said. But if the Southerners continued trying to block it, he would simply put the Senate on a round-the-clock basis and secure passage that way. Attempting to inject a note of reality, some of the other leaders had, the conference minutes show, an utter lack of success. Congressman Halleck asked whether Senator Noland would interrupt consideration of this bill in order to take up other bills. Senator Noland said he was inclined to think it best to drive through on the civil rights bill. Mr. Halleck recalled that for a number of departments, money will run out on August 1st. Senator Noland said that it is a calculated risk that must be taken. Behind Nixon's bluster was, apparently, a cold calculation. If attempts to drive the bill through caused a Southern Democratic filibuster, that filibuster would be a political boon to the GOP. Neither Noland nor the Douglas group seemed to understand, and if Nixon understood, he did not disclose what he understood, that the existence of sufficient votes to pass the bill simply meant that no vote would be allowed on the bill, not even on the motion to bring it to the floor. Noland, anxious to be prominently identified with the civil rights bill he was sure would pass, was keeping his name in the newspapers with a stream of communiques, and his pronouncements were as patronizing as if he were dealing with an already defeated foe. If the Southerners permitted a quick vote on his motion, he said, they would find that civil rights supporters will not be unreasonable, although he made clear that reasonableness would not extend to any substantive weakening of Part 3. The press accepted both Noland's view of his own role, he was now being identified by journalists as the leader of the bipartisan civil rights forces in the Senate, and his optimism. With the Southerners, during the first day or two of debate, generally obeying Russell's injunction to sound restrained and not inflammatory, journalists applauded this stance as if good manners were as important as social justice, and interpreted the restraint to mean that the bill would indeed be allowed to come to the floor. Noland's motion is likely to be adopted by a decisive majority vote without resort to cloture, said the Herald Tribune's Roland Evans. An expected Southern filibuster will not materialize until after Senator Noland's motion has been adopted and the second stage of the battle is underway. White of the New York Times was only slightly more cautious. There was, he wrote, at least an even possibility that the Southerners would reserve their truly implacable resistance until the time to deal with the substance of the bill. And the optimism involved not only the motion, but the bill's ultimate fate. With both sides so reasonable, speculation concerning ultimate compromise is dominating the atmosphere, readers of the Times were told. Noland's predictions in July, however, were not only as confident as those he had made in January, February, March, April, May, and June, but as accurate. His July predictions, too, began to slip, faster and faster, almost as soon as they were out of his mouth. On Monday, he predicted passage of his motion within the week. On Tuesday, he said flatly that his motion would be brought to a vote within a week. On Wednesday, he told a reporter that the debate might run into September. So wildly optimistic were his vote counts and those of his Democratic liberal allies that they appear to have been based on the belief that, since the cause was just, the need for a civil rights bill obvious, and press and public support for it widespread, certainly the motion to consider the bill would pass, and the bill was certain to pass too. Journalistic analyses showed little understanding that Russell was privately insisting not only that Part 3 be eliminated, but that the amendment to eliminate it be agreed upon before he would allow the bill to come to the floor. Most of the journalists somehow managed to ignore a statement Russell had made on the Senate floor that Monday, not long after Noland and Douglas had finished speaking. There seemed to be some misunderstanding on the part of his distinguished colleagues, Russell had said. We are told that it is highly inappropriate to discuss the merits of the bill in connection with the pending motion to proceed to its consideration. That, he said, was incorrect. We are justified in discussing it on its merits at every opportunity we get to discuss it. If that be an unreasonable position for us to take, the Senate must make the most of it. Senators may call it a filibuster if they wish. But whatever it is called, he said, Mr. President, we will resist. We will resist. Resist, he said, not merely during a debate on the bill itself. We will explain and discuss the issues which are embraced in the bill on the motion to take up the bill until we are convinced that each and every member of the Senate fully understands them and all their implications. The South had two opportunities remaining to filibuster. It was not foregoing one of them. And indeed, while the Southern senators' discussion of the motion remained germane, it continued on Tuesday and Wednesday. If an extended discussion is extended long enough, it becomes a filibuster whether it is called by that name or not, and whether or not its tone is, at least at the moment, restrained. Instead of ranting and raving, we'd talk about the merits of the bill, at least for a while. On Wednesday, readers of most newspapers were still being told that this was not a filibuster yet, and that compromise was still the probable outcome. But Philip Graham, in daily touch with Johnson, had a better understanding of the situation, and on Wednesday his Washington Post said simply, "The Senate has begun what may become its most momentous filibuster." The Southerners intended to keep extending their discussion until they got what they were insisting on. It became apparent after a few days that the Southerners absolutely wouldn't take even a cleaned-up Title III, George Reedy was to recall, that if you want Title III, you're going to have to break a filibuster. Asked by a reporter on Wednesday for a response to Nolan's prediction of a September conclusion, Russell said, "If the bill is not modified, we may be here until the snow flies." During the first 3 days of debate, one amendment after another to substantially weaken Part III was either suggested or formally introduced by Midwestern conservatives or Southerners. Determined that their dream bill pass unaltered, the liberals, whom William White called the most ardent civil writers, the Douglas Group, were refusing even to consider proposed modifications. Other, more moderate liberals in both parties were more willing to consider amendments, but not from such sources. These moderates wanted a civil rights bill, but were willing to settle for a more modest one, and were coming to realize that an unaltered bill would result in a filibuster, and no bill at all. Some of them, furthermore, had other legislation they wanted enacted, legislation that might not be enacted if there was a filibuster. More amenable to amendments though they were, however, these moderates were predisposed to distrust any submitted by Southerners who they knew were trying to preserve the South's infamous Jim Crow system, or by Republican reactionaries who gave lip service to civil rights but whose hearts, they knew, were on the side of the South. The moderates saw amendments from such sources as simply the latest attempts to gut a civil rights bill by senators who had been gutting civil rights bills for years. Saw them as attacks on racial justice by senators whose motives on racial justice were indefensible. And even if these moderates could come around to voting for an amendment introduced by a Southerner or Southern sympathizer, what excuse for doing so could they give to those of their constituents who are knowledgeable about civil rights? There was little support in the Senate for any substantial modification of Part III, and without such modification, the bill was going to encounter a Southern filibuster. And the filibuster was going to win. Says Reedy, "I don't think a filibuster could have been broken because the Southerners would have enough allies in the Western states to keep it going indefinitely. You just weren't going to get a civil rights bill with Title III." The Civil Rights Bill of 1957 was going to suffer the same fate as the Civil Rights Bills of 1950 and 1948 and 1946 and 1944 and 1938 and 1936. There was not going to be a vote on it on the floor. It was going to die in a filibuster on the motion to bring it to the floor. The dam that for so long had held back the tide of social justice was going to hold it back again. Civil rights was going to lose. Lyndon Johnson was going to lose. Jim Rowe had told him that it was most important that he get all the credit for a bill. But what if at the end of the day there was no credit to be gotten, but only, as in every civil rights fight of recent decades, blame? Desperately as he was attempting to find a compromise, therefore, his attempts were cloaked in secrecy. Unavailable to reporters for almost 2 weeks down on the ranch, the majority leader was hardly more available after his return to Washington. There was no leaking to journalists, indeed almost no contact with them. His decision to allow Nolan to introduce the motion calling up the bill was evidence of his fears that it wouldn't pass. And in other ways, too, he kept a low profile. Rising at the beginning of the July 8th session to announce the order of business, he did so not by laying out the order, as was his prerogative, a prerogative, of course, which he was customarily adamant in exercising, but by announcing that the minority leader would do so instead. The Senate's pending business, Johnson said, was an emergency measure to authorize construction by Robert Moses and New York State of a huge power dam on the Niagara River to replace one washed away by a flood. But, Johnson said, "I am informed that the distinguished minority leader is about to make a motion to bring up the civil rights bill." And he said, "I should like to inform all my colleagues that the minority leader, in his usual gracious and courteous manner, has told me that after he makes the motion, he and those who support him will resist any motion to proceed to other business until the civil rights bill is finally disposed of." As he was speaking, standing at his front row center desk, Noland rose to stand at his front row center desk, almost at Johnson's elbow, and confirmed that what Johnson was saying was correct. Three senators, New York's Javits and Ives and Robert Kerr, whose Public Works Committee had considered the Niagara situation, jumped to their feet to protest that that situation was, in Kerr's words, an extreme emergency, which must be acted upon immediately. "This measure must have the right of way," Ives said. Johnson said he certainly agreed. "The senator from New York understands, I am sure, that I heartily favor the Niagara bill." But he said it was not his decision to make. "Mr. President, the minority leader has pointed out that he does not intend to have other proposed legislation brought before the Senate." "He was washing his hands of the situation," Lyndon Johnson said. "That is the decision of the minority leader, and I assume of this administration. They will have to accept the responsibility for it." Since the day he had assumed the majority leadership, Lyndon Johnson had insisted on keeping strict control of the Senate's schedule. Now he was abdicating that control. The most accurate indication of the true chances for passage of a civil rights bill was the fact that, in William S. White's words, Mr. Johnson, normally in control of Senate procedure, now in effect folded his arms. Another indication came every afternoon when newspaper photographers sent in messages to senators asking them to come to the Senate reception room to be photographed. Noland, the untitled leader of the Civil Rights Coalition, as White described him, invariably came out to be photographed studying the Civil Rights Bill. Russell and Irvin posed together intently studying it. Lyndon Johnson declined to be photographed. He was trying to distance himself as much as possible from what was likely to happen. Hardly had the fourth day of debate, Thursday, July 11th, begun when two statements made it apparent that the gulf separating the two sides on Part 3 was as wide as ever. Stennis of Mississippi said Part 3 should be stricken, all of it. McNamara of Michigan demanded that none of it be stricken, that the bill be passed with its basic provisions intact. When McNamara sat down, furthermore, Javits stood up to express his concern over the failure by the Senate to take action on New York's vital Niagara bill, and Noland's reply showed how adamant he was about any action that might weaken the position of the civil rights forces. The Niagara bill would not be brought up, Noland said, until the civil rights legislation was disposed of. As the day dragged on, the debate became, in the New York Post's phrase, increasingly bitter. From the far right side of the chamber, Javits shouted across the arcs of desks as he interrupted Olin Johnston of South Carolina, and Spessard Holland of Florida shouted back, literally jumping up and down in rage, with a hostility that leaks through even the carefully sanitized version in the Congressional Record. "I hope the distinguished senator from South Carolina will not allow himself to be cozened from his very proper and very correct position by the importunities of the distinguished senator from New York, aggressive though they may be." One by one, the members of the Southern Caucus, Johnston, Irvin, Eastland, Thurmond, Robertson, rose to denounce the bill in terms that grew less and less restrained. "A rape upon the constitutional and legal systems of the United States," Irvin called it. "The proposed new civil rights division would be a new Gestapo," Olin the Solon said, pounding his desk. "If this monster bill passes, we can all say it has happened here." Eastland's ponderous drawl seemed inappropriate to the sharpness of his words, and to the glare with which he surveyed, across the aisle, that unfortunate row of desks at which sat not only Douglas and Hennings, but Pastore and Humphrey. The Judiciary Committee chairman assailed the measure as a cunningly devised scheme, a devious scheme, and a travesty of justice, and then asked, looking hard at that row of liberals, "We are entitled to know the answer to this question, which I ask the proponents. Do you intend to surround our schools with tanks, troops, guns, and bayonets? Is that the object of the bill, the hidden intent?" Liberals had hoped that Lister Hill, more moderate on some non-civil rights issues than his Southern colleagues, might this time be a voice of reason from the South on civil rights as well. Then Hill spoke. "Let us all, men of goodwill everywhere, join hands and send this measure down to the tongueless silence of dreamless dust," he said. Even more discouraging to Lyndon Johnson, aware that the bill would not be allowed to reach the floor until agreement had been reached on some major compromise on Part 3, civil rights supporters remained insistent that the bill be on the floor before compromise was even discussed. Clifford Case of New Jersey, a Republican and a staunch member of the Douglas Group, rose to deplore any talk of amending the bill before the motion was passed to bring it to the floor. "The immediate matter before the Senate is a procedural one, whether to make this bill the pending business of the Senate," Case said. That was the only matter that should be discussed at the present time. "There will be ample time, once Nolan's motion is agreed to debate the substance of the bill and various amendments. Mr. President, as a sponsor of the civil rights bill, I am certainly not willing to consider changes now." Talking to reporters outside the chamber, Nolan was equally rigid. "There are going to be no amendments agreed to, nor any negotiations or agreements looking toward amendments, until after the bill becomes the pending business in the Senate," he said. The scene in the long, cavernous Senate chamber, Southerners drawling defiance, liberals scorning compromise, the galleries emptying hour by hour as the day went on, as if even the public knew that the civil rights fight had degenerated into a meaningless farce. Very few black faces in the gallery now, as if America's Negroes, whose hopes had died so often on the Senate floor, had come to feel that they were going to die there again and couldn't bear to watch. The scene was depressingly similar to the scenes in the last stages of debates in previous years over whether to bring other civil rights bills to the floor, bills that had, every last one of them, died. It seemed that this bill was going to die too. Time to save it was growing very short. With every moment, the mood of sullenness and hostility on the floor was worsening, hardening. It hardly seemed likely that any amendment from these Southerners who were shouting "rape" and "Gestapo" at the liberals, or from the Southerners' allies, would be considered by the liberals, much less accepted by them. Time might, in fact, run out, without warning, at any moment. The seeming impossibility of compromise and the bitterness in the air might have their effect on the impulsive, easily angered, overconfident Noland. Lyndon Johnson kept glancing uneasily at the minority leader, sitting at his desk right in front of the presiding officer. At any moment, without having consulted with anyone, Nolan might suddenly rise to his feet, ask for recognition, and announce that he would begin rounding up votes for cloture. The moment that word was out of his mouth, it would be in headlines, and so would the companion word, filibuster, that would spell the end of the bill and of all Lyndon Johnson's plans. To save the bill, to avert a filibuster, Johnson needed moderate liberal votes from both parties for a compromise amendment to Part 3. And as the day dragged on, his hopes of getting such votes were steadily fading. And then, sometime that afternoon, Lyndon Johnson, his gaze roving around the chamber, noticed, beyond the angrily gesticulating men in debate, a tall, lanky figure sitting quietly at his desk in the far corner of the Democratic side, in the front row of the last section before the lobby door. It was Clinton Anderson. And Johnson suddenly realized that all week Anderson had been spending much more time at his desk than he usually did. He walked over to find out why. Anderson was sitting there only partly because of his interest in civil rights. Proud though he was of his long-time identification with that cause, he was nonetheless less fervent about the cause itself than about the device that was being used once again to frustrate it. "I'm afraid I'm one of those senators who, coming from a state in which there were few Negroes, never quite acquired a passionate feeling about racial injustice," he was to say. "My principal outrage was rather against the filibuster, which permitted a small body of men to obstruct the business of the Senate." A man who, as Lyndon Johnson often commented, didn't like to lose. His defeat by a Southern filibuster during his term as Secretary of Agriculture had left him with a bad taste in his mouth. And his principal role as a member of the Douglas Group had been to lead three fights against Rule 22, all of which had ended in defeat. He had become somewhat obsessive about extended debate. "I took it as a personal challenge to break the challenge of the filibuster." And he hated to think it was going to win again in 1957, and he saw it was going to, unless something was done. In addition, he had become, since his heart attack, somewhat obsessive about his health, and the two subjects had become linked in his mind. He felt that, I wouldn't get a bit of rest that summer if we had to remain in Washington listening to an endless filibuster. The Douglas Group's most pragmatic and realistic member, one less ideological and more amenable to compromise than its other members, he was also a highly partisan one. Other liberals might discuss the civil rights bill in terms of social reform. Anderson talked also in the language of a tough, practical politician, passionately loyal to his party. And he saw clearly the danger to the party from a filibuster, and felt the Republican maneuvers were at least in part designed to provoke one. Noland seemed thoroughly willing to let the Southerners filibuster the bill to death, an event which would permit him to blame the Democrats for its defeat and permit the Republicans, in future elections, to pose as defenders of the American Negro, he was to recall. I had no intention of letting that happen. Breaking a filibuster once it had started would be as hopeless in 1957 as it had been in previous years, Anderson says. Feeling the pressure more than in the past, the Southerners seemed to sense that this time they had to yield a little if they were not ultimately to lose everything. But they weren't going to yield to the extent of allowing a strong bill to pass. The administration bill would never pass in its present form, he says. The Southerners were determined, and the Northerners didn't have enough votes, and they couldn't break the filibuster. So, unlike the other liberals who had ruled out any talk of compromise, Anderson just sat myself down on the floor and glued myself there to listen to the reason the Southerners couldn't do it. And that Thursday afternoon, shortly before Lyndon Johnson noticed him, Anderson felt he had finally found what he was looking for. Hints kept emanating from the Southerners that a compromise bill was possible, he felt, but there could be no compromise on Part 3 largely because of the fear, enunciated by Russell, that that section could be used to authorize the use of military force against the South. They seemed to accept voting, but it seemed clear to me that as long as Part 3 remained, they would filibuster to defeat the entire measure. They were afraid they were going to have another march through Georgia. Sitting there at his front row desk near the lobby, turned slightly around and listening carefully as the Southerners to his right and behind him spoke, Anderson understood that their anxiety, justified or not, was genuine. And I thought if you could just remove the Southern fears that we would march an army into the South, they'd probably yield thereafter. I finally decided one day that we could stop this thing, the impending filibuster, by removing that one threat. Opening the printed draft of H.R. 6127 on his desk, he pulled out a pencil. At first, he tried to tinker with Part 3, rewording it as other senators had been trying to do. At one point, for example, trying to defuse another Southern concern that Brownell or some other politically motivated attorney general would be able to institute suits without clearing the action with the president. He crossed out on page 9 of H.R. 6127 the word may. In the sentence, the Attorney General may institute for the United States, and substituted in blunt pencil the words, upon order of the President shall. But that Thursday afternoon, Anderson had come to feel that no amount of tinkering would be enough to reassure the South about Part 3. That section, he concluded, would have to be not merely reworded, but removed. Bending over his desk, he turned back to page 9, on which the first 14 lines of Part 3 were printed, and drew a large X across all of them. Turning to page 10, on which the rest of the part was printed, he drew an X across the first 8 lines on that page. All that was left of Part 3 was an innocuous last paragraph. All the rest of it was gone. It was not long after Anderson drew those two X's that Lyndon Johnson walked over to his desk and began to chat. He was curious what I was doing sitting there on the floor for about 2 or 3 days, Anderson was to recall. Anderson showed him his work and said Johnson should arrange to have it introduced as an amendment by some Southerner or conservative who opposed Part 3. And almost without a pause, almost in the instant that Clint Anderson made his suggestion, Lyndon Johnson saw what was wrong with it, and also saw what was right with it, saw what it could mean if only it was used correctly. And he saw in that instant how it could be used correctly. Okay, he said, approving the amendment. But then he added, you do it. The introduction of the amendment by a Southerner or a conservative would accomplish nothing, Johnson saw. It would then seem like merely one more attempt by civil rights opponents to gut the civil rights bill. it wouldn't get him any of the Democratic votes he needed to meet the South's price. Opponents had already suggested dozens of amendments to weaken Part 3. Everyone had been rejected out of hand by Democratic liberals and moderates because it came from an enemy. But there was a difference, a crucial difference, between this amendment and the others. This one was being suggested not by an enemy of civil rights, but by a friend, by a prominent liberal, by a member of the Douglas Group. Johnson felt at that moment, as we know from George Reedy, that moderate Democrats, anxious to find a way out of the civil rights impasse but not willing to accept an enemy's suggestion, might accept an amendment that came from one of their own. He saw in an instant that this amendment should be not merely suggested by, but also introduced by, a friend. In fact, by the man who had written it. "Put the amendment in," Johnson was telling Anderson, "but don't have it put in by a Southerner. You do it." And Johnson saw more in the same instant. When, standing there looking down at Anderson, he said, "You do it," Anderson replied, "How can I? I'm a civil rights man." Anderson was saying that he didn't want to be identified with the foes of civil rights, didn't want to be called a betrayer of the cause. Johnson saw the answer to Anderson's question in the very instant the question was asked. And he also saw in that instant that the answer was also the answer to another aspect of the problem that he had not been able to solve. How to get votes to pay the South's price not only from Democratic moderates, but from Republican moderates as well. When Anderson asked, "How can I?" Lyndon Johnson told him how he could. Without even a pause, he said, "Get a Republican to go in with you. Get a good Republican." Johnson meant that Anderson should obtain as a co-sponsor for his amendment a Republican with impeccable civil rights credentials. Anderson's name would then be linked on the amendment with a friend of civil rights. He would not appear to be participating in an anti-civil rights move. That end could be accomplished by obtaining a Democratic liberal as a co-sponsor, of course. But Johnson's purpose, the purpose he grasped so quickly, went beyond that. If Anderson could obtain a Republican co-sponsor, a Republican civil rights advocate, a Republican whose opinion carried weight with his colleagues, a good Republican, Johnson might be able to get some GOP moderates to go along with the amendment. He might at last, despite Nixon and Noland, be able to crack that solid Republican front. Clint Anderson took Johnson's meaning, and he picked the right Republican, George Aiken of Vermont, whose liberal credentials were impeccable, approached him and, Anderson recalls, asked him if he would join him. After thinking it over for a while, Aiken said in his laconic New England way, "Well, I believe I will." When Aiken gave the news to friends on the Republican side of the aisle, several immediately said not only that they would vote for the amendment, but that they would join Aiken as co-sponsors. Aiken reported this response to Anderson, Anderson reported it to Johnson, and Johnson reported it to Russell, who understood immediately not only that this amendment would give him what he wanted by narrowing the scope of the civil rights bill to voting rights, but also that this amendment, unlike the others, would pass. The Senate would now, as Evans and Novak wrote, be considering not the Russell-Eastland Amendment, but the Anderson-Aiken Amendment, sponsored not by segregationists but by moderate liberals. The change the South wanted would now be proposed by liberals, by respected liberals of both parties. Moderate liberals in both parties would be happy to support an amendment with so impeccable a liberal provenance. With their votes added to those of the South and the Hell's Canyon Bloc, and the 6 or 7 Republican conservatives already enlisted, the amendment would command a solid majority. For the first time since the bill had been introduced in January, Russell could be confident that if he allowed it to reach the floor, there would be, on the floor, the necessary votes to eliminate Part 3. Johnson had met the first half of the South's price. He still couldn't pay the other half, the addition of a jury trial amendment to Part 4. But if that section remained in a form unsatisfactory to the South, Russell would still have another opportunity to use the filibuster on the motion to bring the bill to a final vote. He would not be foreclosing the use of that weapon. A big step had been taken toward meeting his demands, and he could therefore allow the bill to take a big step, could allow it to come to the floor. And by so doing, he would avoid using the filibuster now and thereby keep alive his hopes of avoiding the damage to the South, and to Johnson's presidential hopes that its use would entail. Russell asked for a quorum call so that he would have time to check with moderate senators, both Democratic and Republican, to make certain that his assessment of the new situation was correct. He found that it was. The days of Lyndon Johnson's low profile ended abruptly. Late that Thursday afternoon, there was a dramatic announcement. It concerned the minority leader's motion, but this time it wasn't made by the minority leader. "I hope tomorrow we can work out a unanimous consent agreement on a time to vote," on Nolan's motion to bring the bill to the floor, Lyndon Johnson said. And he said he hoped the time would be during the very next week. Reporters rushed to learn Russell's reaction and were surprised to learn that his feelings had changed, that the Southern leader was now suddenly amenable to that timetable. Suddenly, the name in the headlines about the Senate fight wasn't Nolan or Douglas, but a new name. Johnson seeking vote on civil rights. The next morning, the Southern senators caucused again in Russell's office. Although some of them could hardly bear to go along with his suggestion that they neither filibuster Nolan's motion nor object to a unanimous consent agreement, thereby allowing a civil rights bill to reach the floor, they agreed at last because it was Russell who was making the suggestion. He reminded them that should the bill later come to a vote, they would of course be able to cast their own individual votes against it, so they would be able to tell their constituents they had opposed it. Johnson thereupon introduced the agreement, which did indeed set the vote on Nolan's motion for the next week, for Tuesday, July 16th. "Mr. President, I have at the desk a proposed unanimous consent agreement. Is there objection? Without objection, the proposed agreement is approved." And then delivered a speech. "I believe the Senate is proving that it can meet any issue with dignity and thoroughness," Johnson said. "This may disappoint those who were looking for a bitter and bloody brawl, but it will not disappoint the American people. I think we all realize that in a very real sense the Senate is on trial, and the American people want us to win." And when, immediately after the speech, photographers sent a request to the floor to have Johnson step into the lobby to have his picture taken, they found him newly agreeable, and the Associated Press photograph reproduced the next day in newspapers across the country showed him sitting between Russell and Noland as the architect of the agreement that would at last bring a civil rights bill to the Senate floor. On Tuesday, July 16th, Anderson sent his amendment to the desk, saying, "I do this jointly with the able senior senator from Vermont, a man of outstanding integrity and a man of the highest character, with whom I delight to associate myself." And Aiken told the Senate why he was co-sponsoring the amendment. "We who support the cause of civil rights know that Part 3 is unacceptable to a sizable segment of the Senate. Its retention in the bill could result in no legislation at all during this session or any other session in the near future." After a last outburst from Harry Byrd, who could barely restrain his rage at what was happening, charging that Earl Warren, the ADA, and the NAACP were the evil geniuses behind the bill, he called Warren a modern Thaddeus Stevens, and shaking his fist at Mitchell and Wilkins, who were sitting together in the gallery, he insulted them by likening them to Goldie and Dusty, the fictitious African-American twins whose ignorance and laziness had enlivened a 1940s radio comedy. "There they are," he said, "the Gold Dust twins." The Senate voted 71-18 to make H.R. 6127 its pending business. The 18 votes against the motion were all from Southerners. Gore and Kefauver of Tennessee did not vote with the South, and neither did Yarborough and Johnson. Johnson announced that his support for the motion to bring the bill to the floor was not to be construed as support for the bill in its present form. "Some of us to whom this bill is unacceptable in its present form are ready to allow it to be debated out of a decent respect for the convictions of others." At the conclusion of the vote, Lyndon Johnson and William Noland, each seated at their front row desks, leaned across the center aisle and shook hands. Both had broad smiles on their faces, Johnson because he had won, Noland because he didn't realize he had lost. That realization may not have dawned fully on the minority leader for 4 days. It was just a few minutes after the vote that allowed the bill to come to the floor that Anderson stood up at his desk near the far end of the Democratic arc and said, "Mr. President, I call up my amendment, The amendment that, by striking from the bill its key provision, made it in effect a different, much weaker bill than the one Noland had been supporting. And no sooner had the clerk read out the amendment's title than Johnson made a parliamentary inquiry of the chair to emphasize that the amendment was now the pending question, and the chair confirmed that it was. Noland had been outsmarted again. He had not wanted to accept amendments, but Johnson's inquiry meant that the bill could not be voted on until after the amendment had been voted on. The vote on the Anderson-Aiken amendment was not held for 4 more days to give senators a chance to get their views on the record. During those days, Noland apparently grasped what was going to happen in the vote, and just before the clerk called the roll, he made an emotional last-ditch plea to his Republicans to stand fast and defeat the amendment. 10 days earlier, however, Johnson had seen in a moment, the moment in which Anderson handed him the draft with the two X's penciled across it, that if Anderson got a good Republican to co-sponsor the bill, the near-solid Republican front on Part 3 would be broken. And when the roll was called now, it was broken wide open. No fewer than 18 of the 46 Republicans, not only every Midwestern conservative, but Aiken's fellow Northeastern moderate liberals, Salt and Stahl, Noland's own assistant leader, Cotton, Flanders, John J. Williams, and H. Alexander Smith, went against their leader and voted to eliminate Part 3 from the administration's bill. Johnson had seen in a moment that if Anderson introduced the amendment himself instead of letting a Southerner or a conservative introduce it, Democratic moderates and some liberals would accept it, and they accepted it with open arms. Kerr and Monroney of Oklahoma, Chavez, Theodore Green, Bible, Freer, they all joined the Southerners in voting for the amendment. Johnson had so many votes lined up behind it that he didn't